I can speak for myself and then understand there are other routes in which people come to an interest in Thomas. For myself, it was just an attempt to understand the Protestant Reformed tradition. What were theologians like John Owen or Stephen Charnock saying? Why does Owen, when he's combating Socinian heretics in the 17th century, decide of all the people to appeal to theologically for help, why does he go to Thomas's Summa Contra Gentilis? And why does he go to Cardinal Cajetan's commentaries on Aquinas? Why is he appealing to Dominicans when there's Calvin, and or even maybe more scholastic, Zanchius?
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Well, in this episode and the next, we break from our typical podcast style to bring to you two Credo colloquies. I sat down with philosopher and theologian James Dolezal to discuss the importance and significance of Thomas Aquinas. James has great skill and insight into Aquinas, but even beyond Aquinas, James has an eye towards Protestants, trying to understand why it is that some of the best Protestant scholastics retrieved Thomas Aquinas. As we talk with one another, James also reveals a number of important concepts for us today, such as participation in the likeness of God and the analogy of being, and so much more. I hope you enjoy these two Credo colloquies, and go to the Credo website for more conversations just like these with other great theologians today.
James, thank you so much for joining me. We often have conversations like this behind the scenes, off the camera, that sort of thing. And we're batting around all kinds of ideas and discussions. But this is really good where you and I can come together like this and be able to dive a little bit deeper into some questions and areas where those who are listening and watching and reading Credo may have questions of their own, and they're trying to work through those. And maybe it's hardest for them in areas of philosophy, because if they don't have a ton of training there, it can feel overwhelming. And so that's where I think you have been a real blessing to all kinds of people, because you're able to speak into theology, but with a philosophical mind that pays attention to the great tradition and our past. So I'm really looking forward to jumping into this. And I know that one of maybe the first question that people want to find out, what does James think about this? It probably has to do with Thomas Aquinas. So why Thomas Aquinas, and why now is there so much interest? And what is your take on that?
I think there are probably several ways you can come at this. Why Thomas? Why now? My easy and facile answer would be, why not? but that's not going to get to the question being asked. I can speak for myself and then understand there are other routes in which people come to an interest in Thomas. For myself, it was just an attempt to understand the Protestant and Reformed tradition. What were theologians like John Owen or Stephen Charnock saying? Why does Owen, when he's combating Socinian heretics in the 17th century, decide of all the people to appeal to theologically for help, why does he go to Thomas's Summa Contra Gentilis? And why does he go to Cardinal Cajetan's commentaries on Aquinas? Why is he appealing to Dominicans when there's Calvin, and or even maybe more scholastic, Zanchius?
Yeah.
And certainly Owen knows these sources and can appeal to these sources, and often does, of course. But there are certain kinds of arguments and times when theological precision, a kind of laser-like precision with highly sophisticated terms, is just the best way to answer the problem that you're facing theologically. Whether it's with whether it's with regard to questions of habit and virtue, where Owen will lean on Aquinas's insights with regard to human psychology and ethics, whether it's questions of the nature of God or the distinction of persons in the Godhead according to relations, I pick Owen just because he was a favorite of my own. And for me, it was a question of why do my favorite Puritans seem to, with some frequency, go back to Aquinas. Now, the first person, two people put me onto this. One is Carl Truman, and the other, the writings of Richard Muller.
Oh.
And Muller is writing really an intellectual history of mostly 17th century Reform thought, continental and English, British. And he's looking for the sources, theological sources, and the interlocutors of the Protestant Reformed tradition. And I began to realize that I wasn't going to quite grasp my own tradition until I began to understand more clearly how it is that they were using Thomas and why they thought it was profitable for them to do so. Well, that's one thing. I can say, well, look, they're doing it, I should do it too. But I found out very quickly after, and maybe some of our viewers have found the same, that just saying, well, I'm going to go read Thomas for myself is not exactly that simple of an endeavor, in part because there is a sophisticated philosophical set of assumptions and commitments that Thomas makes, and he does assume that his readers are fairly well read and versed into those metaphysical assumptions. And so he's making arguments from principles that I myself at that time hadn't seen for myself and wasn't convinced of. So for myself, I had to step back a little bit and go and give myself that education that you're saying you didn't receive, and I think many of us didn't receive it. But I ended up finding it in some strange places, meaning there wasn't a Puritan handbook on metaphysics. They just assumed that you had received that in your primary schooling somewhere and were ready to go, and I wasn't ready to go. And what I found helpful were several 20th century introductions to philosophy and introductions to metaphysics, mostly written by Catholic scholars to train Catholic college students in the basics of metaphysics. And I began to find those as a way to sort of get a foothold. They were pedagogically excellent books that were helpful in sort of laying that groundwork. And then when I went back and read guys like Charnock and Owen or Turretin, or now in translation Maastricht, as you're reading these older writers, I discovered that these 20th century Catholic college metaphysics textbooks ended up being a key to understanding a pre-modern Thomistic metaphysical thought world that would have been the assumption of so many of our Reformed forebears. And not just in that first and second generation, but even down into the 18th century, the works of John Gill. John Gill is still assuming that you have a basic grasp of a substance metaphysic and a realist epistemology. And so the question for me, it was a question of being able to access my own tradition by being able to access what they were accessing. That's just me trying to understand, and maybe others have had that same route. And there are reasons why we're able to do it now better than we have in the past. I think maybe not least of which is Richard Muller's work, really connecting clear lines from Aquinas to the Protestant scholastic tradition. Not only Aquinas, Anselm, of course, is in the mix, Boethius is in the mix, Pseudo-Dionysius, later and also a contemporary of Aquinas's, Bonaventure, is in the mix. So I don't want to make it sound as if it's exclusive, unalloyed Thomism that's being carried into the Reformed tradition, but a lot of Thomism is being taken over into the Reformed tradition. And as soon as you get some of Aquinas's basic commitments and styles of argument down, you begin to find that it's not just when they cite him that they're leaning on him, It's when they're basically appropriating his entire line of reasoning, reproducing it in their own theologies without attribution, not because they're trying to hide the sources, but because it would have been common knowledge at that point that Aquinas, we all know Aquinas is the source for this way of reasoning about this particular topic. As far as right now, why now? Part of the reason is the historical work has created a base of scholarship for younger theologians to go and recover an older reformed way of theologizing. I think there's another answer to your question, which isn't the one that personally moved me into it, but I think it would be an answer, which is people burning out on anti-metaphysics or metaphysics in the hands of modernity, which reduces all metaphysics to nothing but contemplating one's own thoughts and never actually getting out there to the real world. The anti-essentialism of modern science as well has actually provoked a kind of reactionary movement among philosophers. So you have the neo-Aristotelians, guys like David Oderberg, who writes a book called Real Essentialism, and he's arguing for the reality of natures and essences over against materialism that just thinks that we are a collation of particles, matter, and motion, that there's actually a stable core called an essence that isn't reducible to just the set of physical parts that you have. So this recovery of an Aristotelian-ish metaphysics has also sort of laid the groundwork for thinking of Thomas Aquinas again as a plausible source. Mm. There are several other reasons I would give, maybe a third and final one. There's also been, through the 20th century, a massive upsurge and proliferation in Thomas's thought comprehensively, especially his metaphysics, as you see it in what they call the handbook tradition, but also in a serious attention to his text and not just simply reading him through his maybe Dominican interpreters, but reading him afresh in his own context, in primary texts, and lots of secondary literature supporting that research has come out. And Protestants are leaning on some of that for our own understanding of Aquinas.
So let me throw out, there are so many, but let me just throw out a couple of terms or phrases that those who are, you know, just at the beginning of their journey are going to bump into and discover, oh, this is incredibly important to understanding Thomas Aquinas. First is the role of reason in natural theology, which often gets caricatured.
As if he's made an idol of reason, as if in the use of reason, he is in a certain sense leaving his dependency on God behind. Sometimes he has been accused, kind of in some of the neo-Calvinist literature, I'm thinking of Herman Dooyeweerd and some of that literature, Aquinas is caricatured as reasoning autonomously, as if human reason could know nature apart from God. And I think the nature of that critique of Aquinas is unfair to him. Mm-hmm. If you read, you certainly aren't going to find statements where he claims that that is the implication of his view. But is it even a valid, necessary and or valid inference from the way he theologizes that he's effectively elevated reason above Scripture? Yeah. That would be a problem where he's making reason the judge of even special revelation. But the critique has often been that he's reasoning as if he could reason soundly without some kind of special revelation intervening in the process. Mm-hmm. And just a couple thoughts on that, if I can be brief about it. I think some of that critique of Aquinas comes from an embrace of a sort of idealism among even Reformed Protestants, not across the board, but by some, Dooyeweerd I've mentioned, in which the idea is that man as man cannot know nature as nature, and therefore man requires some kind of special, extraordinary light beyond the light of reason and beyond the intelligibility of nature. He needs something else to intervene in the knowing process in order to illumine nature that otherwise would be dark and silent to him. And so some will argue for what they call revelational epistemology. Karl Barth argues for that. Cornelius Van Til argues for that. And what they're effectively assuming is, like with the early modern philosophical skeptics, that man naturally cannot access nature, and therefore he needs a set of a priori principles by which to, or not just principles, concepts perhaps, even to disambiguate nature and make it knowable to him. Mm-hmm. Immanuel Kant had argued this. That Dutch neo-Calvinist tradition obviously rejects Kant's exact proposal, a set of synthetic a priori by which you then go out and sort of, the lenses through which you view the world, or worldview, to put it very simply. Whereas Aquinas' view of this is that we don't necessarily need a supernatural source of light intervening between the light of our own agent intellect, yeah, and the, I'll put it this way, the luminosity or the knowability of natures. And he deals with this, and so their argument is, you assume that man can know nature without special revelation, and he, and his answer effectively is, much like Francis Turretin's answer after him, or much of the Protestant Reformed tradition's answer, which is, yes, you're right. I do think that men can know nature without necessarily requiring a supernatural light or illumination in the process of knowing nature. Now, in the process of knowing redemptive history, of knowing God as triune, of knowing the hypostatic union, the second coming, the resurrection, none of these things are inferred from nature, and for this we do require a supernatural light. But do I require a supernatural light to know the essence of a horse?
Yeah.
Can I arrive at the universal of horseness, equinity, without special supernatural revelation somehow intervening in the knowing process? And Aquinas would say, yes, you can. And this, but then when he gives his reason, I think it lays to rest the accusation that he's reasoning autonomously. The idea that he's carrying on in the knowing of things apart from God would never have entered his mind.
Yeah.
It's particularly in his commentary on Boethius's De Trinitate, the first couple books of that, where he writes commentary, and he's actually arguing against Augustine's Illuminationism, which it's always fascinated me that the classical Reformed scholastic view tended more toward Aquinas's realism than it did to, and his view of our knowledge of nature than it did to Augustine's Illuminationism, though I leave that to the side. But he's arguing against Augustine's Illuminationism, and his whole argument, he basically invokes Augustine's own doctrine of divine providence, yeah, and says, effectively something like this, and this is just a crude reduction of what he's, of how he's saying it, but he'll say things like, man cannot know anything at all apart from God. I mean, that's almost a direct statement, and he'll say that repeatedly in his commentary, and what he means is that God is the one who makes the nature of things knowable and intelligible, because everything is an imitation of something in God, and therefore it is luminous and knowable insofar as it participates and imitates the divine nature. So God is the one who makes nature luminous and knowable. He's also the one who gives man the intellect and the mind by which he can, in encountering nature, abstract from the particulars the universals that I could take from the horse Black Beauty, a concrete particular, the knowledge of equinity, horseness, and then return very briefly in a judgment and say, this thing is a horse. Mm-hmm. Aquinas would say that entire knowing process depends upon God at every step. Yeah. The horse, its existence, and its knowability. Me and my sense encounter with the horse depend upon God, who orders the encounter, he says. That my agent intellect that actually shines a light on the phantasm of my sense experience and sees the universal as distinct from the particular, sees the hoarseness of Black Beauty as opposed to the particular of Black Beauty, and then is able to categorize and see it as this kind of thing and make a judgment about its nature or essence, and then return in a statement and say, and judge, this is a horse thing. Okay, I don't say it that way. I say it's a horse. But that he would say all of that at every step of the way depends upon God, in whom we live, move, and have our being, and from whom we receive life, breath, and all things, including all acts of cognition, and every step in which we receive sense forms, in which we move from sense knowledge to intellectual knowledge, in which we have the power to make judgments. And so Thomas situates that entire knowing process really in a doctrine, in a very thick and textured doctrine of divine providence, in which God is upholding and sustaining every aspect of this realist experience, yeah, in knowing the world. Thomas's only argument is that over and above the light of nature, which is created by God and sustained by God, we do not, for our natural knowledge of things, require an extraordinary second illumination from a supernatural source. But the critique of Thomas has been that he reasons autonomously and independently of God. And I think just in the commentary on De Trinitate, on Boethius' De Trinitate, he really puts that whole argument to rest. Where it does hold up is if you assume, unlike Thomas and the Reformed Scholastics, that we can't know nature without supernatural revelation illuminating it, because nature in and of itself is to us dark and silent until supernatural revelation helps us to see it somehow. That, with that, Aquinas and the kind of classical Reformed tradition would disagree. But it isn't really fair to say that that's autonomy from God.
Hi, friends. This is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting this conversation to tell you about something quite exciting. Each November, we have a special meeting hosted by the Center for Classical Theology. This is an arm of Credo, and it's an opportunity to come together once a year in order to hear a lecture from a well-known theologian, in order to renew and restore classical theology today. This November, Michael Horton will be giving this lecture, and he will be addressing us in San Diego, California, talking to us about what it means to affirm sola scriptura as it was originally intended, and how we do that in light of Catholicity. I look forward to hearing what he has to say, followed by a panel of other theologians discussing it as well. I hope you will join me in San Diego this November.
Okay, here's another one, participation, which some have said this is so important. Sometimes it's missed. It's missed in Aquinas, but this is so important that if you miss this, you won't understand his doctrine of creation, or even, bigger still, his distinction between the creator and the creature properly. So what does he mean by participation?
Well, let's say what he doesn't mean, because I think what a lot of ears, modern ears, hear when they hear participation is some kind of ontological convergence where we become by nature in some measure identical to God. For Thomas, a thing that is identical in nature doesn't participate. You only participate when you take in part, or even more exactly,
a sharing, grasping.
But then a sharing how? And this is this, and it's a sharing by imitation. It's a sharing by likeness. It's a sharing by conformity to the divine ideas. It's a sharing by imitating something in the divine nature somehow, which happens among the image bearers at the level of intellect, will, righteousness, dominion. But then it happens even down among the lower creatures, in which there's a great medieval, in which they imitate something in God somehow. So there's a great medieval maxim, nothing in the effect that is not first in the cause. Mm-hmm. Or the way I put it to my students in bumper sticker form, a thing can't give what it ain't got. Put it like this. And if all things are from him, through him, and to him, Romans 11:36, then everything in the world must, Calvin puts it this way, he says, there is no atom in the world, but there are bright sparks of his glory.
Yeah.
And I think this actually gets at the same idea, that there's nothing in the effect that is not in the cause, either formally or virtually in the cause, so that everything in the world in some respects is derivative from and imitative of God. And in so much as God is the one who gives it its existence and who gives it its intelligibility, this is what he's after with regard to participation, that immediate dependence upon and likeness to God, who is our exemplar, and we are the imitation, we are the copy. This is also why he would not say that, for instance, the persons of the Godhead participate in divinity. They are divinity. Mm-hmm. Participation is always a similitude of some lower order that is not identical with that in which it participates. And so since the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are God, and they aren't just instantiations of God or partakers of the divine nature, we are and will be partakers of the divine nature, but the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit just are the divine nature subsisting. And so he would not use the language of participation for the Trinity. He would say participation is a way of describing only for him the way that creatures relate to either to universals in a natural philosophy, but in a creation theology, most especially how they relate to their maker from whom they derive their being, both their whatness and their isness, their existence and their essence.
So this is important, isn't it? Because if someone says, well, Thomas, for all of his emphasis on the creator-creature distinction, he has this doctrine of participation, and so he just brings in a mutualist understanding in the end anyways, you're saying, no, that's not really accurate to participation in the likeness of the divine essence. Is that what you're getting at?
Because participation does not mean ontic identity. Yeah. It has an imitative and derivative connotation about it. Yeah. So that there's a godlikeness and even a conformity, a partaking of the divine nature by communion and fellowship and likeness and conformity, but never by ontic identity. If it were ontic identity, Thomas would not call it participation.
Yeah.
So if people hear ontic identity when they hear participation and they're opposed to that, then they're already on Thomas's side. Now we're just wrangling about the right words for it.
Yeah. It seems to also distinguish Thomas from, say, much of modern theology. And in many ways, it kind of does away with that claim that, well, if as a Protestant, if you are retrieving Thomas on participation, that you've somehow succumbed to that modern mutualism. But it sounds like you're saying instead, no, the very idea of participation as Thomas defines it actually guards us from that.
Yes, it maintains the creator-creature distinction because God doesn't participate in God.
Yeah.
Only creatures do by way of created similitude and likeness.
Yeah.
So I think it maintains that. He doesn't begin to merge those into some kind of ontic sameness, which is important. I mean, there are reasons for Protestants to disagree with aspects of Thomas's teaching, though I don't think that his teaching on participation per se is that area of disagreement.
Okay, here's another one. Pure act or pure actuality. What does Thomas mean? And why is pure actuality so fundamental to the if we could call them this, the philosophical building blocks of Christianity? Or a Christian philosophy, for that matter.
Let me start with your second point. Yeah. Pure actuality establishes the absoluteness of God. Mm-hmm. In our Reformed confessions, whether Westminster, Savoy, Second London, we all confess in Confession 2:1 that God is most absolute, that he's the irreducible one behind which there is nothing, who's not reducible to principles more fundamental than himself. Everything is reducible to God as its cause maker, but God is reducible to nothing. If he were reducible, he wouldn't be the first cause of all being, and we'd be looking for some other reason for the world.
Yeah.
Because we'd be looking for a reason for God. Now, how does pure actuality play into that? All creatures, and this is where Thomas locates the creator-creature distinction most precisely, all creatures are composed of principles of act and passive potency, most especially existence and essence, because there are compositions of act and passive potency that aren't exhibited in every creature. So, for instance, in angels, there's no composition of form and matter because they don't have a material component. And if form is the principle of actualization, form is what makes the matter to exist and to exist as this kind of thing. The whatness of a thing makes its matter to be this kind of matter. So your humanity is, your matter is human matter. But what makes your human matter to be human matter? It's actually the actuality of your form. So your form provides the act of humanness, your matter is what receives it, and your matter also contracts it. So there's a sense in which your humanity is contracted to your matter. Mm. Your matter depends upon your form or your humanity for the kind of thing it is. It receives that from your soul. Your soul depends upon your matter in a certain sense for its location and its circumscription, its concrete instantiation in a material entity. So that these two principles, so if I could take Matthew and reduce you to principles of active passive potency, mm-hmm. I could reduce you to the actuality of your form and the passive potency of your matter that receives your form, that which gives act, that which receives act. And insofar as that which receives act is not identical to that which gives act, because passive potency isn't actuality. So for instance, we're both seated in this conversation together, but we're both potentially standing, but we're neither of us is actually standing. And so when we're done and we stand up and we take off the microphone and all this, we will have actualized potential, but then at that point we won't be potentially standing anymore, we'll be actually standing. And so there's an irreducible alterity between principles of act and passive potency. Passive potency is the capacity for act. Act is that which makes the passive potency to be or to be realized. But when it comes to the first cause, so my point is, for us, we're reducible to principles of act and passive potency, more basic than ourselves. But with regard to God as the absolute first cause, he's pure act because his actuality of being, particularly his existence, is not contracted to a corresponding essence that's really distinct from his existence. Your essence and your existence are really distinct. Whereas in God, existence and essence are identical. And so for this reason, he's pure act because his act is not contracted to a passive potency principle. So, I mean, in Bible terms, this means that we can just name him as I Am. Yeah. And it's an interesting name, I Am, because it's you're expecting like a contraction of some sort. So every time you use statements like this, you say I Am, but it's always in response to Matthew, are you seated? And you say I Am. Matthew, are you hungry? You say I Am. Matthew, are you tired? I Am. Matthew, are you married? I Am. Are you a father? I Am. But every one of those assumes that you are, and then it contracts to something. I am married. I am sitting. I am hungry. I am father. I am. And so all of Matthew's is's, I am, are all of your is-ing is actually contracted to a particular what-ing. I know that's not a word, but you take my meaning. So that all of your is contracted to a what. And so you're not pure is, you're always is specified and contracted to this what or that what. If that's a way of putting it. With regard to God, though, when he says, I am that I am, or I think the way Durham in his commentary puts it, I am the is-ing one. That's how he renders it. But I think it's a fascinating way of rendering that text in Exodus 3:15. I am the is-ing one. God says I am, and then it's an uncontracted is-ing, which is a way of saying what I am is that I am. Existence and essence are identical. This alone, now to the point of absoluteness, this alone, pure act, not contracted to a passive potency principle, thereby reducing God to principles more fundamental than himself, this alone can establish God as the one from whom and through whom and to whom are all things. His absolute universal creatorhood, which is established throughout Scripture repeatedly and explicitly, really does presuppose that God is his own existence. He is act, but not bounded by a principle of essence distinct from that act of existence. It's his absoluteness. So when the confessions call him most absolute, it really is because he's pure act that he's most absolute.
So let me ask you this. You have written a book called All That Is in God, published with Reformation Heritage Books. And this pure actuality really comes into that book and informs the doctrine of God at a critical point at which many evangelicals have compromised or modified or forfeited in some way or another specific attributes of God. So taking what you've just said about pure actuality, how does that protect us moving forward from making some of those mistakes?
I think, let me just take one example. Yeah. and this from the book. And I should qualify this and say, in the book, it doesn't sound as pointy-headed as I just made it sound in our conversation, I hope. I think one idea, I'll just give you one example. The idea that God is himself moved by or impacted by the agency of the world somehow, so that God is involved in a world in a give-and-take relationship, in which he gives and then he also receives from us. But if he receives from us, that is to say, if there are states of being or mind or emotion in God that are in fact the effect of our agency operating upon him, then God could not be pure act, because there would have to be something in God by which he received an actualization or a determination of being from some agent. In which case then, God would have to be a compound of principles of act, but also principles of passive potency, really irreducibly distinct from those principles of act, just to be open to being impacted and changed and altered by your action upon him. And I, as I argue in the book, I don't think that invoking sovereignty for the process of God being changed by the world, but only because from all eternity he decided to so be changed by the world, is going to ameliorate the problem here. Because the problem is, even if God sovereignly ordained exactly this sort of relationship where the world changes him somehow by impacting him, even changing him accidentally, which is to say, you know, from sad to happy or some kind of something small like that, or changing his mind or mood in any way, even that would require a real principle of passive potency in God distinct from his actuality. And then God would be composed of parts. Yeah. He would be composed of principles irreducibly distinct from each other and more fundamental than himself as a whole. And he would be a composite whole at that point. Mm. You would lose the doctrine of divine simplicity. You would lose the irreducible absoluteness of God. God would now be a relative absolute, not a most absolute. And it's interesting that our confessions all say that he is most absolute, which kind of raises the question, well, are there things that are absolute but not most so? And the answer is yes, there are. They're called angels, but we won't go into that, who are relatively absolute but not most absolute, because they are subject to certain kinds of changes, not all the kinds that we are, and also they are composed of existence and essence. And so they are reducible to principles of their own being, more fundamental than themselves. And while they are relatively absolute, meaning an angel can't catch a head cold because he doesn't have a head. He can't, you know, there are certain things to which he's not susceptible. There are certain actualizations, or I should better say passive potencies, he doesn't have and therefore is relatively more absolute than maybe we are. But most absolute, absolutely irreducible first cause of all being requires that God not be composed of principles more fundamental than himself. But if he's open to being changed by the world, then he has to have the capacity or the openness, the passive potency for that change, which then has to be distinct from his actuality. And then God is reducible to principles more fundamental than himself. I think that undermines all of the biblical, even if you didn't have a kind of philosophical apparatus like Aquinas gives us with the language of pure actuality, you would still just have all of your Bible verses saying that all things are from him, through him, and to him, that he is the first cause, that nothing exists apart from him. In other words, all the existential primacy texts in Scripture would more or less present the exact same dilemma, which is if God can be moved or changed by the world, even at his own behest, he could not possibly be irreducible in being, because there would be principles more fundamental than himself. But that's I think once you see how act and passive potency are in fact principles of being more fundamental than the things comprised of them, if you can see that, then all sorts of modern ways of theologizing about God become untenable.
Well, this discussion needs to continue in our next conversation. We're going to move forward just a little bit. And we have to say we're able to have this conversation because of Reformation Heritage Books, who, of course, have published your book, All That Is in God. They've also published, and I think you might even mention it at some point, some more, Protestant and Reformed scholastics like Peter van Maastricht and his theoretical practical theology. And so we're really blessed to have those as well. So I look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise. Thanks.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.